Well, shalom and welcome to another 2 hours of Jewish Soul. I'm your host, Charlie Bernhout. This is show number 271. Well, what can one say about the evil brutality of our enemy? This past week, four rabbis, Rabbi Moshe Twersky, Avram Goldberg, Aryeh Kupinski, and Kalman Levin, were brutally murdered, and a Jewish policeman, Zidan Saif, was also killed in this brutal attack from our partners in peace. I'm taking a departure from my regular type of programming, and I choose to replay a two-hour special from March 14th, 2011, some 3.5 years ago. This was in response to the Fogel family massacre. I know this is going to sound a little complicated, but the cantorial selections that you'll be hearing this first hour and the second hour were from a special prayer service that took place in 2006 at Temple Beth El in Brooklyn in response to the attack by Lebanon on Israel. We will be hearing from Rabbi Pruzansky, a wonderful rabbi from Teaneck who really says it like it is. And when we say, Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, there's nothing new under the sun, the words that he will be speaking in Nadia Matar, and during the second hour, we'll be hearing from Aryeh Eldad and David Ha'ivri. They, unfortunately, are still appropriate as they were then. They're still appropriate today. So allow me to go back to March 2011 and let's hear this special that was for the Fogel family, which is equally relevant to what happened this past week. It's very sad how quickly we forget, but we are forced to remember when these savage events occur. Okay, allow me this, going back to March 14th, 2011. Good evening and welcome to another 2 hours of Jewish Soul Music. I'm your host, Charlie Bernhout. Each week I try to bring you the best in a mixture of Chazanis and everything but Chazanis, but this evening will be a very special program. I had been preparing a special Purim program with a lot of comedy and nonsense, but quite frankly, I decided to change the format for this particular program based upon what happened just a couple of days ago, Friday night, Shabbos, Friday night in Israel. What happened was yesterday I gave a lecture out in Long Island at a shul on the history of the situation that's facing Israel. And later on, I ran to New Jersey to my son's home. My six-year-old granddaughter had planned a surprise birthday party for my son's 43rd birthday, and we were there. And I was looking at my six-year-old granddaughter and my four-year-old grandson, and I was thinking that just as these children were butchered in Itamar, one day it could happen to them, perhaps, because of the hatred and because of the, well, I would just say the hatred and the evil that seems to be sweeping not only Israel, but much of the world. And so I just decided that I would change the program. We'll be playing certain selections from a very special program that Cantor's World ran on July 19th in 2006. This was in response to the Lebanese war, and it was a special prayer service at Beth El, and we'll be hearing various selections from that very, very stirring event. And many of you who are listening were there. And I know that you were very, very, very moved by that experience. And I hope that the prayers that you'll be hearing this evening will also move you. I also, this morning, recorded three interviews, brief interviews, one with David Ha'ivri, who is the liaison officer for the Shomron Council, Nadia Matar, who is a co-founder of Women in Green, and Aryeh Eldad, member of Knesset. And in about 15 or 20 minutes, we'll be hearing a live interview with my friend Rabbi Przanski of TNAC. But let's get in the mood, if you will, for this program. And it's certainly something very special for me. Let's go back to 2006 Bethel and hear the first selection of Horachamim. It's actually at the East Karim, and it will be chanted by Yaakov Motzin. Again, this was at a live davening. It was a prayer service for our brethren in Israel who were attacked by Hezbollah and the Lebanese.
Elokeinu letohevo imeshayor tzadikeyelom vinekoim nikemas Kakosu besoyraz moyshe ishvelayki arni. Yoshi, 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 Echiper Ademosoi Amoi Venokam Yavoshiv Yavoshiv Letzorov Echiper Vashem Shoichain B'tziyon
B'tziyon
Uvechis v'yakov v'idvash Nehemar Uvechis v'yakov v'idvash
Domi moi some zachor loy shuchach tzakavasanovim loy shuchach oy tzakas tzakasanovim loy shuchach Sakrach basanovim Ki doirei shidomi moisam zachar Loi shuchach Hoi Tzakasanovim
zakavava za novim ljubovoj šuhah. Zakas, zakas za novim arninu gojim amoj. Kidam avodov ikoim harninu gojim amoj. Kidam avodov
Yarim Ra.
Okay, I hope that's coming through. Rabbi, are you there? Hello?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, a little technical problem. We just heard Yaakov Motzen, and that was at a live prayer service that we did 5 years ago when Israel was attacked by Lebanon, and we'll be hearing more from that particular service. But right now, I'm so pleased to have with me live on the phone Rabbi Pruzansky from Teaneck, New Jersey. Good evening, Rabbi.
Good evening, Charlie. How are you?
Okay. Certainly, we're going through very, very difficult times right now.
That was quite a haunting melody you just played.
Yes, yes. Very appropriate, to say the least.
Very appropriate.
Well, Rabbi, what can we say about the evil of the world?
It's very difficult for good people to relate to that. The barbarism, the savagery, it's not something that's part of this world, and it's something that literally evokes the Nazis. A Nazi is capable of slitting the throat of an infant, of stabbing a three-year-old in the heart, someone devoid of any type of humanity. And that's what we're dealing with there. And unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority is breeding that type of savage beast.
Well, that's for sure. And Islam itself seems to be doing that. We know that even the savagery in 9/11, the idea of just killing innocent people seems to be...
Yes, I think we'll have a moratorium of about 3 days in hearing Islam referred to as the religion of peace. Maybe 3 days, but the world has a short memory.
Yes, for sure, for sure.
You know, it's almost 3 years to the day of the massacre at Merkaz Harav, the yeshiva in Yerushalayim, when again an Arab gunman walked into a yeshiva and shot a group of teenagers, just who were sitting and learning, and then in fact for a time they were hiding in the library. 8 students were killed. So it's sad that the month of Adar, which is a month of great joy to us, is utilized by these enemies of mankind and the haters of the Jewish people as a time to deprive us of the natural joy that every religious person should feel, every holy person aspires to. It's worse than sad. It's depraved. And it's the type of depravity that is so beyond the pale that it doesn't make the impression that it should. And I think the Israeli government was correct in releasing the horrific images, the photographs of the parents and children who were killed, but I don't know what type of effect that has on the world at large. Certainly not on Israel's enemies, but even on the West, which considers itself civilized, is no longer moved by that. They've already decided that who was right and who was wrong in the Israeli-Arab conflict, and nothing is going to change that paradigm unless we ourselves change it.
Just as an aside, I received my copy of The New Yorker in the mail today, and the first lead article is about Netanyahu. And on the first page of the article, I just want to read one sentence. The occupation - illegal, inhumane, and inconsistent with Jewish values - has lasted 44 years. Now, the occupation, illegal, inhumane, and inconsistent with Jewish values. This is the kind of media propaganda that the Jews are falling for, and the whole world, that this is an occupation and it's inhumane. What about
right,
the inhumanity?
It was a Jew who wrote that article, I imagine so, but not a very intelligent Jew. How could it be against Jewish values to settle the Jewish heartland that God bequeathed to our ancestors, to our forefathers, as an everlasting possession for their descendants? How could that be un-Jewish?
Right.
It also sounds like someone who's never visited the area, because in truth, I visited there hundreds of times. It's possible for Arabs to live there and for Jews to live there. There's enough land for everybody, but there's not enough land on earth that can accommodate barbaric, brutal, animalistic murderers. There's no land that can contain them, nor is there a cell that should hold them. But And this is where I am a little concerned, because I think the what this person wrote, that it's the occupation and all its so-called evils that has perpetrated the troubles in Israel, I think we play into that. The Israeli government, Prime Minister Sharon, who used the language of occupation 7 years ago.
Yes.
And it's Prime Minister Olmert who said that we are occupying someone else's land. And it's Prime Minister Netanyahu who said we have to agree to a second Palestinian state between in the land of Israel. Again, carve up and partition the land of Israel.
Right.
So, in fact, we're bringing this on ourselves. And I think it's because the secular Jewish leadership of Israel is paralyzed by a worldview that is completely secular and political security oriented, and they don't see the greater value in the land of Israel nor the religious dimension. It's completely ignored. And I think the primary problem that we have is that the Israeli government has failed for almost two decades now to articulate a narrative or an argument that's appealing. Essentially, their argument is, the Arabs say to us, you stole my house, give it back to us. And the Israeli doesn't say, what are you talking about? This is our house, God gave it to us. No, the Israeli says, well, we did steal your house, but give me proof that you won't harm me and I'll give it back to you. And the Arab says, that's crazy, get out of my house, you're in my house. We don't have a right answer. We don't have a narrative that impresses anyone. So every concession that Israel makes or even entertains simply reinforces the Arab narrative. Think about it. When Israel releases terrorists from prison as a goodwill gesture, they're sending the message that the terrorists were not justly imprisoned in the first place. When they remove security checkpoints, it sends the message that the checkpoints had no real security dimension and were simply a means to harass Arabs. We had a distinguished visitor in Shul this past Shabbos, Dr. Gerald Schroeder, the scientist. And he said, of course it's ludicrous to remove checkpoints during a war. Look, every American passes through several checkpoints on the way to an airplane. So any American, including, of course, Obama, who insists that Israel remove its checkpoints, should first demand the removal of American checkpoints at airports. There's far more terrorism in Israel without checkpoints than it is in America at the airports. So what audacity people have to insist that Israel remove its checkpoints. But when they do that, all they do is they cater to that understanding that there's no security. And when they freeze construction settlements, what they're saying is that building in the settlements in the heartland of Israel is illegal and unjustifiable.
Right.
And then they wonder why the UN wants to declare those settlements illegal. They themselves are declaring it illegal. And when Israel suddenly allows building in response to terror, it's shouting out to the world that settlement in the land of Israel is not a natural right, but it's just a tool of vengeance. That's their message. And that message is received by audiences across the world. And that message really is a cardinal sin. Because our claim to the land of Israel is not based on history, and not based on security, and not based on the Holocaust, but based on the fact that the creator of the universe gave it to our forefathers, and through them to us. And in fact, that's what Ben-Gurion himself said to the Peel Commission in 1937. And that's what Menachem Begin used to say. But it's been decades since we had a prime minister who believed it, much less said it. And therefore, they just keep parroting losing arguments, arguments that don't impress anyone. And to think that they're going to mollify Jews in Israel by building a few hundred apartments in places where it was already approved and in the pipeline but has been frozen for no good reason, that itself betrays a fundamental miscarriage of leadership and even unfitness for leadership. They should be allowing Jews to build wherever it's legal, wherever the land is theirs. Build! That's the land of Israel.
Well, the Arabs are building unchecked. I mean, there's no such thing as a permit. Wherever you go, construction.
It's even worse than that. You know, 2 weeks ago, the Israeli government sent in a goon squad to evacuate Gilad's farm, Khalat Gilad.
Yes.
Now, let me tell you something about that your listeners will be interested in. Gilad's farm was named after Gilad Zahar, the son of Moshe Zahar, who was killed not far from that very spot. Moshe Zahar owns thousands of dunams of land in the middle of the Shomron that he bought privately from an Arab owner almost two decades ago. He built a house on the land, he farms land, but it's large enough to have other places where they could build. What could possibly justify the government of Israel telling people they can't build on privately owned land? It's not state land that the state gives them and can withdraw their rights from. He paid good money for that land to an Arab. Who are they to tell him he can't live on that land? It's outrageous. But that's the problem of Likud. Likud lets down believing Jews, right-wing Jews, time and again, and they become the enforcement tool of the ideology of the left.
Rabbi, by the way, what they did on the Gilad farm, Chavat Gilad, was a signal to the Arabs that here are Israeli soldiers and police going in, shooting. They used rubber bullets, but they might as well have been real bullets for what their intent was. They see what Jews are doing to other Jews, and the message is, yes, they are there illegally.
You are absolutely correct. And when they state that it's illegally, it's a message to the Arabs, it's a message to the nations of the world, and then it becomes open season. And the reaction, look, I think Netanyahu's passion is real, it's justified, he's angry, he's embarrassed by it, but he's a leader. As a leader, he has an obligation to do more than just get angry and make short-term concessions to the right wing, build a little here, which you can also stop in 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, the first thing he should do—the first thing he should do—is get rid of Barak.
Yes, the first thing he should get rid of Barak. The second thing he should do here's the hypocrisy, which is mind-boggling. You know, Yaakov Katz, the Chaver Knesset Katzala, introduced a bill just a few weeks ago to allow Israeli law to apply to residents of Judea and Samaria. That is to say, they would no longer be under governance of the military in Israel. The defense minister would not have to approve every building like in the rest of Israel.
Right.
This was a bill that Netanyahu supported 2.5 years ago when he was in opposition. He said, of course, it's natural. Why should Israel distinguish between the rights of Jews to build in Kfar Saba and just a few miles east of Kfar Saba? It makes no sense. He supported it. Now, of course, he opposed it. And the whole coalition opposed it. And 4 people voted for it. That's not values. That's not leadership. They have an ability, they have the capacity to make a statement and to change the framework of the debate, to institute a new paradigm, a paradigm that's based on the land of Israel being the land of the Jewish people given to us by God. And it's not something that's completely far-fetched or mystical. The fact is, we're living in a time when religion is the most powerful force in the world again. Think about it. We have Christians, Muslims, fighting Christians and fighting Jews, radical Islam. We have Christian evangelicals who are supporters of the State of Israel, the keenest supporters of the State of Israel, because they believe in the Bible.
Right, and they believe in God, Rabbi. I mean,
and they're puzzled why the Israelis don't. So in fact, by adopting a religious perspective on this dispute, we'll have joined the debate instead of standing on the sidelines uttering irrelevancies about we need this security, we need this checkpoint. It's all nonsense. The land is ours because God gave it to us.
Well, Rabbi, Rabbi, you understand that in the eyes of the majority of Israeli secular Jews, you and I and all the rest are seen as fanatics, religious fanatics. I mean, how can anyone believe all this?
Yes. Then the problem becomes, as you well know, how can they answer the question, why are they there? What mm-hmm. right do they have to be there if not for the Torah? And the sad thing is, they know they have no answer to that question. That's why they feel guilty. That's why they leave Israel in droves. That's why many of them support the Arab cause, both in Israel and when they leave Israel, because they cannot answer that fundamental question, why are they there? Believing Jews know why they're there. And when you know why they're there and your policies are rooted in your values, then the word concession is lost from the diplomatic lexicon overnight. There are no concessions. Concessions of land are not possible because this is what God gave us. And non-Jews are welcome to live in the land of Israel as long as they embrace basic norms of morality and accede to the sovereignty of Israel. But think about it. Israel's prime minister can say to the world, we're here because the Almighty gave us this land. And we're staying here. We're not going anywhere. We don't feel guilty about it. We're not defensive. We're not awkward. This is it. This is why we're here. If an Israeli prime minister stated that in a public forum, the debate would change overnight. Yeah, world leaders, many Jews, would be apoplectic in the short term. But in fact, in the longer term, Israel's case will be more persuasive and winnable and would have the added advantage of being true and being holy as well. That's why the Jewish people are in the land of Israel. Netanyahu doesn't have that yet. And I think the time has come for Israelis, especially religious Israelis, to coalesce around a believing Jew, a Jew who can fuse faith and policy. For him and have him be the prime minister. The votes are there. The problem is there's such a division,
yes,
unity in the religious Jewish sphere that it can't happen, should happen. In fact, it must happen.
Rabbi, of course, one of the problems is people like Shimon Peres, you know, a few years ago when he lost the election, he was asked what happened. He said, we lost. And he said, who lost? He said, the Israelis. Well, who won? He said, the Jews.
And he's very sensitive. That was 1996 when he lost to Netanyahu.
Right.
He said that. Israelis lost and the Jews won.
Yes, and he...
And yet, you know, there's no accountability in Israel. He was one of the primary figures responsible for the Oslo debacle.
Right.
And rather than being imprisoned, he's the president.
Right, which boggles the mind. And, you know, can you imagine that he said, if we get rid of Judaism, there'd be no anti-Semitism because they really don't hate Israelis, they hate Jews. Now, can you imagine what a sick person this is?
He's locked into a particular worldview that he cannot escape. He can't think out of the box. He can't even look at events and say the facts on the ground have proven his theories wrong. He's beyond that. And so he should not be in a position of leadership. Unfortunately, he is. So he's a great public mourner. And he has great anecdotes and analogies. But the fact is, he weakens Israel's case every time he opens his mouth because he makes Israel only more vulnerable and more subject to pressure from the West.
Well, Rabbi, where do we go from here?
I think in the short term, we have to grieve, we have to mourn, we have to have renewed emphasis on building. I think there are enough people within the government who recognize that settlement, facts on the ground, is the only way. The Arabs are not negotiating. The Palestinians have no need to negotiate because they get everything handed to them, pressure in Israel. Israel has to say negotiations are over. Over. We're taking a 10-year timeout. We're building our land. We're focusing on our society. We will respond with great and overwhelming force to the slightest provocation. Every Jewish finger that's harmed, so 10 Arabs should feel pain as a result. Everyone. Overwhelming force. If they want to leave the country, open the doors and let them leave. But they should not be able to lift a hand against a Jew. No more negotiations. No more concessions. Build on the ground. Develop the economy, strengthen the world of Torah, bring believing Jews into leadership so there are Jewish values that undergird the policies of the state of Israel, and then you'll have a strong Israel. Look, Netanyahu is the only world leader today who feels necessary to bend to Obama's dictates. Every other leader in the world ignores him. Netanyahu somehow feels he has to cater, has to pander to whatever Obama asks for, or else. There is no or else. America itself is declining, unfortunately. Israel has to carve out for itself its own destiny, and its destiny is based on Torah, based on faith, based on Jewish values. I don't think he's the man for it. And you have a lot of people, members of Likud and the right wing in Israel, Shas and others, they know he's not the man for it, But for political reasons, for monetary reasons, they stick with him. They have to have the self-confidence to say, it's time Torah Jews took over and guided Jewish destiny to its natural fulfillment. That's what we have to do in the long term, but that long term is not decades. That long term is not even half a decade. That could be in just a few years as well. If we don't discredit the old paradigm of land for peace, and Netanyahu's planning even more concessions, then the situation will get worse before it gets better. Yet many people in the government now, whether it's Benny Begin, whether it's Uzi Landau, even Avigdor Lieberman, they know that this can't work. They're very intelligent people. They see the facts. They're not hamstrung by ideology. They know it's not working. They know the only way to survive is to build the land, take the war to the enemy, and stop being defensive. They know that. If they continue to kowtow to Netanyahu, then they have to blame themselves as well. Shas has to take a greater leadership role. The Ichud Lumi, they have to find a way. They try, but they're in the minority. They have to try to influence the government even from the outside. I think it's most important is that religious Jews stop voting for these parties, stop recycling failed leaders from the past, failed secular leaders, and develop a cadre of leaders that can carry Jewish destiny forward. That is the only way that Israel is going to prosper in the years ahead. They have to do that. The current leadership can't. They can grieve and they can get angry and they could have temporary corrective measures. But right now they don't have a worldview that's going to convince anyone that their cause is just. And that's a disgrace, because there is no more just cause in mankind than the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel after two millennia of exile.
Wow. By the way, Rabbi, perhaps you heard about the so-called 50 Jewish leaders who met with Obama a couple of weeks ago. And what I got back from a person who attended was the fact that Obama clearly said, the Palestinian issue is important to me and you have to solve it. And he really doesn't understand the situation. And this man came back to me and was livid. I mean, that here is the President of the United States really showing his lack of faith and concern for the state of Israel.
Well, Charlie, if the measure of the prophets of old was their willingness to speak truth to power, then we have no prophets. Those things have just degenerated into photo ops where people, they shake hands, they take pictures, and listen to speeches that offend them, and they're not allowed to ask tough questions. They're not allowed to argue, politely argue, mm-hmm. but to say you're on the wrong path. This is not it. Look what Israel's done. Look what the Arabs have done. If they're afraid to say that, they're not leaders. They're just heads of organizations
yes.
that, because they're wealthy, but it doesn't. Yep. They don't really accomplish much in Jewish life.
No, so
they should know to speak directly
right.
to power, speak truth to power.
So Jewish leadership is failing us not only in Israel but here.
Right, it's a problem, but again, it also is a rectifiable problem. And by the way, we shouldn't excuse one other group. We have people. I mean, the Israeli citizens are the ones who keep voting these people in. And the American Jews are the ones who keep sponsoring these organizations and their titular heads. There really is no reason for that. I mean, American Jewry is floundering, and that's one of the reasons they're floundering. But that can also be corrected. There has to be a willingness to look reality in the face and say, this is not working. The abandonment of Torah is not working. The abandonment of Jewish identity is not working. The abandonment of Israel is not working. The universalistic approach of brotherhood and friendship, it's not working. Those are fantasies. Those are illusions. In the real world, the only fact that counts for anything is that God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people, and we're back. And we say, you know, the haunting tune that you were playing right before I came on, Harninu Goyim Amo,
yes.
it ends, V'chiper Ad Maso Amo, that the land itself should atone for the people. Better, the people should atone through the land. Build the land. That's the greatest response we could have to the atrocity that took place just a few days ago. V'chiper Ad Maso Amo. Let the land itself be appeased through construction, through settlement, through Jewish life, and then we'll be able to put an end to Jewish mourning.
Amen. Rabbi Prusansky, thank you so much for sharing your words with us.
Thank you. I hope to speak to you on happier occasions.
Yes. Amen.
Shalom. Be well. Good luck.
Shalom.
Well, we've been listening to Rabbi Prusansky of Teaneck, New Jersey, and let's go now to an interview that I had this morning with Nadia Matar. Nadia Matar, co-founder of Women in Green.
I have with me on the line a dear friend, Nadia Matar, who is co-founder of Women in Green and one of the great activists and heroines of our generation. How are you, Nadia?
I'm fine. You're catching me here in Israel, preparing already for the reaction to the horrendous massacre that happened this past weekend on Saturday.
Yes, it really struck home. I mean, these tragedies they never get easier, that's for sure.
They always try to discourage us, and they try to pass on a message as if we have no legitimacy to be here on our land. But there is an expression in Hebrew that says, the more that they hit us, the more that they attack us, the stronger we get, and the stronger we are determined to make sure that this land will stay in our hands. And to make the world understand that the land of Israel belongs to the people of Israel, and that the struggle here is not about settlements or about giving them land. The real struggle here is about Islam against the Western world. And the world has to start understanding this. What we have here is a problem worldwide, and we are here at the forefront of the struggle against Islam. And we are very strong. The Jewish people are strong. We know that God gave us this land. And we are not going to give up on the country. Every time they hit us, every time they massacre our children, we are even more determined to stick to this land, to build it. And we expect the government of Israel also to, in reaction, not only allow us to build the mere 400 buildings. What we want and what we need and what has to be done is that the government of Israel has to bring 1 million Jews to Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria is the spine of the Jewish people. It is our homeland. It is our biblical heartland. When the Jews were praying for thousands of years, next year in Jerusalem, they did not pray to go to the discotheques of Eilat or of Tel Aviv. They were praying to go back to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the Golan, Gaza. That is our biblical heartland. The one thing we demand from the state of Israel is to build over 100,000 new units and bring here 1 million Jews. But first and foremost, to declare sovereignty over all of Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria is part of Israel like any other part of Israel. And the tragedy is that in 67, when we liberated this area, we did not declare sovereignty over this area. And that is what needs to be done right now. And that is what we are pushing towards, and that's what we are demanding from our government. And that is what the majority of the Jewish people want. We voted for this government because the majority of the Jewish people are strong, and they love their land, they love their tradition, and they expect their leaders to be... and we know, by the way, that the majority of the American people are with us also in this demand and in this knowledge that the Arabs do not want this or that settlement. The Arabs want the destruction of the state of Israel as the first course to continue their jihad in Europe and in America. And the majority of the American people know that in order to face Islam, we have to be strong, and we have to, there's an expression that says, respect yourself and other people will respect you. We have to have a leadership that knows how to fight terror, and how to be firm and say, this land is ours.
Well, there is a failure for the world, and unfortunately many Jews, to understand that this is not an issue of settlements, so-called settlements, or even Judea and Samaria. This is existence of the Jewish state, because let's say God forbid, they even gave away Judea and Samaria. That's not what they want. Their maps all show the entire state of Israel as part of their land. And anybody who doesn't recognize this, it just kills me when I hear people, oh, if we would just get rid of the settlements and those damn settlers, there'd be peace. I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing in the world, that they just don't understand that they've been fed the hatred and that we took their land. And they're not just talking about settlements. They're talking about Haifa and Tel Aviv.
Exactly. Those people have to be told and reminded that the PLO, the terrorist organization PLO, headed by Yasser Arafat, was created in 1964 when we had not liberated yet Judea and Samaria. So what was he so-called liberating in 64? Haifa and Be'er Sheva and Tel Aviv, etc. And people have to be reminded of the pogroms against the Jews by the Arabs in 1929, of the entire Jewish community in Hebron, when there was no state of Israel yet. So why were they butchering Jews? Why were they killing Jews then? Because the Arabs do not accept any presence of the Jewish people on its homeland. And that, no matter what borders we are in, they will try to destroy us and annihilate us. They can't handle the fact that we came back to our homeland, that this is our homeland, and they will never accept that. So the only way we can survive here is by being strong and by having a leadership and the people saying, nothing will help you. Every time you, God forbid, every time you touch one of our children, kill one of our children, we are going to build another Jewish community. The terror will not pay. At the contrary, every time you will hurt a Jew, you will, with your own hands, build another Jewish community in the land of Israel. That is the language we expect from our leaders.
By the way, just as an aside, yesterday I gave a talk at a temple in Long Island in Smithtown. And that one fact that people just ignore and just sort of pass over, the fact that Arafat, in 1964, when they had the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and half of Jerusalem, they had that. So what was he liberating? The Palestine Liberation Organization. It's
very
so clear.
Important.
And when Barak, I mean, this insane Barak, I mean, and we're still stuck with him, when he offered Arafat 90% of Judea and Samaria and part of Jerusalem and a right of return, and Arafat turned that down, wasn't that the clear message that that's not really what they're after? They're after the total Jewish land of Israel. And somehow or other people just pass over that, but that's the fact.
People don't know the facts, or people don't want to remember the facts, and people indeed have to remember that between 1948 and 1967, for 19 years, we were not in Judea and Samaria. It was occupied by the Arabs. Judea and Samaria was occupied by Jordan, and Gaza was occupied by Egypt. For 19 years, nobody demanded the creation of a Palestinian state, because that's not what they want. They don't want a Palestinian state. The only thing they want is the destruction of the state of Israel. That is what they want. And it is well known, the salami method of first let's try to convince those gullible, naive Jews that we want peace, and let's try to get out of them as much as we can, and then we'll attack the rest. It is so simple. It is so clear. It is Chamberlain in 1938 made the same mistake when he signed the Munich agreements, thinking that he was bringing peace to this earth. And 2 years later, at least, he was honest enough when he saw that Hitler did not want peace, but used those agreements to conquer all of Europe. At least Chamberlain had the decency to say, I was wrong, and everything would have been all right if Hitler had not lied to me. Unfortunately, the people on the left here, those who signed the Oslo agreements, the Oslo architect and the other leftists in the world, do not have that humility and decency he had to admit their mistake and to say we were wrong, and they don't want peace.
By the way, Nadia, the thing that, one of the things that really gets to me is when people say that you and I are against peace. I mean, I am against suicide. You're against suicide.
We're not against peace. We want to live in peace, and the Arabs want us to rest in peace. That's the only difference.
Wow. I haven't heard that one lately. Oh, gosh. Nadia, how can we laugh? Oh, wow. Well, Purim is around the corner. At least maybe a laugh, but we're living such serious times. Of course, this tragedy that occurred in Itamar,
it's
just an example of the fact that you cannot let your guard down, that even if you have a period of so-called a peaceful interlude, the evil and the hatred is there and it's lurking and it will explode at any time.
People have to understand that those since Oslo, the Arabs here in the area have educated their youth. Not only since Oslo, always, but since Oslo, they have received the tools to do this in a more formal manner with a Palestinian authority who has been unfortunately legitimized by the government of Israel. And their school books basically teach hatred to the Jewish people, to the Jews, to any Jew. They're being taught already with their mother's milk,
right,
that their dream is. You have their shows. You see
Sesame Street. Just I want to be jihad, shahadi.
The children sing that they want to become suicide bombers and kill Jews in where? In Jaffa, in Tel Aviv, in Haifa. They don't even talk about the settlements. We have to understand that we're dealing with a mentality here, with Islam, who see the Jews and the Christians as dhimmis. Dhimmis is a second-class citizen. And no matter what, we who are not Muslims, whoever is not a Muslim, whether we are Jews, Christians, or Hindus, we will all be, always in their eyes be second-class citizens. Who they are superior to us according to Islam, and their job is to do a jihad against us. That is their religion.
Yes.
And nothing is going to change that.
Yes.
And that is not only here in Israel. The same problem is in Europe now with the millions of Arabs who are little by little conquering England and Belgium and Scandinavia. And the time has come for you guys to wake up. You guys, I mean, you guys in Europe and in America,
sure,
and everywhere. We here, we have God on our side, thank God, and we have faith. And when we fight for our land, you have to understand that this is a world struggle.
Yes, by the way, 80% of the mosques in the United States have been paid for by Saudi Arabia. These are the Wahhabis. And what do they expect to happen in those mosques? To talk about peace or to talk about Sharia law or to talk about the takeover of Islam? Anyway, you're going to be responding to this. Do you have any...
There is a big struggle going on now on the hills, in the community, in Judea and Samaria. You have to understand, your listeners have to understand, you have Judea and Samaria, you have some 150 or 180 Jewish communities, and in between the communities, you have empty hills, or hills that used to be empty. But over the last two, three, 4 years, especially the last 2 years, the Arabs have received funding of tens of millions of dollars from the European Union, from Oxfam, from USAID, to help the Arabs take over those hills, which are our hills, which are state lands that belong to the state of Israel, which are meant to be hills where we are going to expand and be able to live in the future generations. They have started taking over not only by building tens and tens of thousands of illegal Arab buildings, but also illegal Arab agriculture. And Salam Fayyad, in fact, said a few months ago, today's challenge against the occupation and the settlements is to invest in agriculture in Area C. Area C is the areas where Israel is under full control. But despite that, he wants to take over, especially in Area C. We will plant 10 million trees, he says here, and he's quoted here. The same thing in a few months later, where he says that the main struggle is against the settlements is to take over all of Area C. And we are responding to that by planting on all the state lands that we can, and that obviously we don't have the funding, unfortunately, that they have, the tens of millions of dollars. But wherever we can, now we are dealing with an area in Gush Etzion, in El Azar, in Netzer. Wherever we can, we call upon everybody to help us plant and safeguard the state lands for the future of the Jewish people. And we have already managed to safeguard and save tens of dunams. Had we not planted there, those areas would have been taken over and stolen basically by the Arabs. And we urge all the listeners who agree with what we're talking about to be a partner in this endeavor and help us save the land of Israel. And you can, if I'm allowed to, Charlie,
okay,
give our website.
Please, please.
We have a website, www.womeningreen.org. All information can be seen there. You can also click on our video link and see our latest videos that will explain to you what is going on here. And it's really a battle for the land, mamash, really on every meter, whoever will be stronger to take more land. And we are dealing here with a giant, with Arabs who are funded. You do not understand. Up till 2-3 years ago, some Arabs were working land with their little donkeys and their very simple material they had, and they were working their own land. There is a little bit of private Arab land, and I will not ever say that I want to take that over. But over 90% of the lands in Judea and Samaria are state lands that belong to the state of Israel. And over the past 2 years, we have seen this unbelievable phenomena where the Arabs have all of a sudden the most fancy and modern tractors and equipment, and that just every day we drive out of our house towards Jerusalem or wherever we drive to, we see our hills being stolen and robbed. And it's unbearable. And instead of just kvetching, as we say in Yiddish, or instead of complaining,
yes,
we say we can do something about it. We believe that, and I talk here for my partner, Judith Katzavel, and myself, and the other women in green, we believe that if we do, and we start doing, then also God comes to our help, and we can change the crease. It is in the power of the people to change the crease. We saw that in 1979 when mere 13 women who lived in Kiryat Arba, and the government at the time did not allow the Jews to return to Hebron, 13 women and 45 children entered Beit Hadassah in the middle of the night, and they said, we are here to stay till the government will return the Jews, allow the Jews to return in Hebron. And to make a very long story short, everybody should look up the story of the Hadassah women in Hadassah. After a year of those 13 women staying in that building, thanks to them, the Hebron was reopened to the Jews, and the Jews returned to Hebron. It is in the power of the little people to change the crease. Sometimes our leaders need a little oomph, a little push from below, and they need a little bit guidance from the people, and it is in our power to do so. And well, that is what we believe in.
Nadia, I wish you the strength and the fortitude to continue the good work that you and Women in Green are doing. And
thank you, Charlie.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you. And anybody who wants to come is who's in Israel on Friday can join us for the plantings we're going to have in honor of the Fogel family that was massacred. And we are going to say we are strong and we continue to build this land.
Amen.
Amen. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom.
Okay, this brings to close the first hour of our program of November 24th, 2014. And stay tuned for the next hour of this special. It's, again, a rebroadcast of something. Did I say it's November 24th, 2014? But it's a show from 3.5 years ago. And we'll bring it back on the facts during the second hour.